Welcome to Chimpions. This actual play RPG podcast takes place in a setting based on the Secret World Chronicle novels.
Stop. You can't get help these days, can you? This is ridiculous. Right. You are going to edit all that out before we post this, aren't you? Good. Now, sling your hook. Welcome to another episode. This week, we're going to do things slightly differently. Firstly, I'd like to congratulate Douglas Blythe and Ray Case, our competition winners. We also had a third competition running for email-only entries, but we seem to have had no entries to that whatsoever. So unless anyone contacts me and tells me otherwise in the next week or two, we will think of an alternative competition for the last copy of the Champions Complete rules. I'd also like to give a big shout out to I Need Lager, who's given us a rather glowing iTunes review, so thank you very much for that. In this episode, we won't be following our intrepid group of heroes, so sit back, grab a hobnob, and enjoy. So hello, and welcome to a very special episode of Chimpions. Today, I'm joined by the rather amazing Stephen S. Long of Hero Games, I believe, Stephen. Are you still a partial owner?
Yes, I'm still a partial owner of the name of the holding company is DOJ Inc., but we do business under the name Hero Games.
And that's amazing. I mean, I played, I think, the Champion system as it was then. Oh, from the 80s, early 80s, maybe?
Yeah, that was quite a while before I owned it. But yeah, I started in 81 or 82 myself.
Yeah, so yeah, I guess for the listeners, especially those that aren't familiar with it, because if they're anything like me, I used to play a lot of games, but I didn't really take any notice of who the authors were or anything. It's just, I like the system, don't I, or whatever. Would you like to maybe fill them in on a little bit of your background? And
Sure, I'll give them a little bit of the history of the company and then of me in general.
Oh yeah, that would be brilliant. Yes, thank you.
Yeah, the company started in 79 or 80. It was started by three guys primarily, Steve Peterson, George McDonald, and Ray Greer. George was bored during a lecture at, I believe, the University of Virginia and began designing a superhero game in his notebook rather than paying attention to class. And gradually this evolved. He looked at what other people were doing and gradually got his own ideas down on paper, came across a points assignment system for superpowers that was being used by a friend of theirs named Wayne Shaw, and adapted that. What ended up being the first edition of Champions really didn't look anything like what Wayne did, but Wayne certainly deserves the credit, as I understand it, as the inspiration for the whole idea of building with a point buy. And so the guys finally decided they had something that was worth publishing, and they sort of had to teach themselves to publish. It's not like it is today where you can just take your manuscript to Lulu or to Lightning Print and they'll turn it into a book. They had to actually do it the old-fashioned route where they cut out blocks of text and pasted them on storyboards and then sent that in to get printed. And they ended up printing, I want to say, 1,000 copies, and they took it to Origins 1981, which was held in San Jose, and it became the big hit of the show. And things sort of went from there. They began producing more books, doing more things with the system, and eventually, of course, it occurred to them that a superhero system, because a superhero system has to do anything you would see in a comic, from a really high-tech character to a mystic character to a guy with a lot of skills, could basically be reformatted to do anything. And so they began doing other games like Espionage and Justice Incorporated and the first Fantasy Hero. And they went on doing this as long as they could, but it was simply too much of a workload for the amount of time that they had, given that none of them were doing it as a full-time business. They all had other things going on. And they eventually worked out a deal with Iron Crown Enterprises to publish the Hero Games books. And Iron Crown assigned a very smart, talented guy named Rob Bell to oversee the line. And that really began in the late 80s. I would say primarily with the publication of the fourth edition of Champions, which took place in 1989. That was the first time they collected all the material from all the different games into one and published it as one generic system. It was the first time they'd taken all the skills and things from all the different books and figured out how to make them work together so that you had the extensive skill list from Espionage and the superpowers from Champions and the magic from Fantasy Hero, and they found a way, they made it all work together. And that was, you know, sort of the first renaissance of Hero that really, it helped boost the game's popularity. It saw the publication of a lot of books that, you know, showed you how to use the rules to do different genre things, like Aaron Alston's amazing Ninja Hero book. And then eventually, in 1983, my first book, Dark Champion. I started publishing with them in the early 90s, 91, 92, writing some articles for their magazine, Adventurers Club. And on the strength of doing three or four articles for Adventurers Club, I decided, hey, I could write a whole book. And as it happened, I could, and that was Dark Champions. I had been playing a character at the time who was a gun-toting vigilante, sort of in the mode of the Punisher or Rorschach, and realized there was no real game material covering those types of characters. And I decided I could write a book about this. At the time, I was practicing law. I was an attorney, and so I had a certain amount of background in some of the subject, and I was able to research the rest of it. And so sort of taking my cue from Aaron's Ninja Hero, I wrote up a book showing how to do all sorts of nifty vigilante, gun-toting vigilante stuff using the Hero system. And after that, the bug had bitten for me, and over the next three or four years, I guess, I wrote, four or five more books, I think, for them. I did The Ultimate Martial Artist, I did The Ultimate Mentalist, I did a bunch of other magazine articles. And then for a while, the company sort of went quiet. For various reasons, you know, remember the mid to late 90s was not the best time economically, and, you know, things sort of, you know, lay fallow for a while. In the late 90s, they were looking into, they ended up selling the game to a company called Cyber Games that was going to revitalize it and do things. But unfortunately, that didn't really get anywhere until my partners and I in DOJ Inc. came forward and bought the rights to the Hero Games assets from Cyber Games. And then we started publishing with the release of the fifth edition of the rules in 2002, and, you know, have been going along since then. We ourselves have slowed down a little bit due to the economics of the gaming industry, but, you know, we're still here and kicking, and, you know, hope to be around for quite some time. If we take the 15 years since we began, we've published something like 110 or 115 books.
Wow, that's very impressive.
We're pretty good by most standards, and have had a great time doing it. As I often say to people, it beats real work.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would love to be able to do something similar to that. Unfortunately, I don't really have the literary skills, or certainly when I'm putting it on paper, to pull something like that off, I don't think.
I think most long-time or hardcore gamers probably have at least one game supplement in them. The trick is having the discipline to write it down and the skills to make it good, you know, good enough for people to read, and then the wherewithal to get out and sell it. You know, a lot of people who entered the gaming, I know people, a lot of people who came into the gaming industry and eventually left it, not because they were tired of writing games, but because they wanted to write games and they found themselves actually having to run a company. And running a company is a very different thing from designing role-playing games.
Yes, yeah, I can imagine. I mean, yeah, just trying to do the promotion on a fairly small podcast, really, is just interesting, especially with no funding. Just trying to reach out to people on things, you know, the social media nowadays, isn't it? And I guess nowadays it's so much easier for little endeavours like ours, where we're just doing it on the side, and really we're just doing it as our own form of entertainment, really. You know, it's quite easy to connect with at least a small group of people. Yeah.
And similarly, the barriers to publication have fallen with the advent of Kickstarter. You know, Kickstarter now makes it possible for somebody with a good idea to get the funding to do it. That still doesn't necessarily mean they have the skills to do it well. But the fact is, if your idea is good enough and it appeals to enough people, you can get the funding to do it. And that is a pretty, you know, impressive thing. I wish we, you know, if we'd had Kickstarter 15 years ago, we might have structured our business a little differently, because it's a great way to make sure enough people want your product to make it worth publishing.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I haven't really looked at the Kickstarter side of things, although spending all that time on social media trying to draw up a lot of interest in ours, you see everyone else doing their promotions, and it's interesting. I don't think I'd be brave enough to go down that route.
More than one podcast has funded itself through Kickstarter, so may not hurt to give it a try.
It might not. I will certainly look into it a little bit more seriously. I mean, we've gone down the Patreon route, which is very modest at the moment.
Yeah, I have never done a Patreon, just because with other things I have going on, I'm reluctant to try to promise content on a regular basis. But at some point, I'll probably give in and do one.
Yeah, it seems a good way of, as I say, you know, as it is incredibly modest at the moment. But sort of research-wise, I went and had a look at some of the more popular actual play type podcasts.
Yeah.
And seen what they're managing to achieve through there. And it's quite amazing the generosity of people who enjoy the content and are just willing to make some small donation. It can seem sort of stack up.
Yeah, I back four or five Patreons, and I enjoy all of them. I think they're a great way for, you know, people of the right background and temperament to get content out to people.
So, yeah, anyway, sorry, I've dragged you over to sort of my narcissistic side, it would seem. But going back to yourself, so you were a lawyer originally, is that correct?
Yes, by training, I was an attorney.
Attorney, sorry, yes.
Yeah, attorney, lawyer, whatever. In the terms of the British legal system, I guess I would have been a barrister, because I was what we call a litigator over here.
Right.
More so than a solicitor. But yeah, I practiced, I clerked for a federal judge here in town for 2 years, and then I was in private practice in a couple of other cities for 4 years, and then finally decided I wanted to try being a full-time writer and game designer. And as it turned out, I was able to do that.
So, yeah, what made you make that decision? Because it seems quite a big jump. I'd imagine that's quite a lucrative profession to work in. And
it is. Well, I was working for small plaintiffs firms, so it wasn't necessarily as lucrative as some of the things you hear about. It was a matter of wanting to chase a dream. Partly it was a matter of, you know, temperamentally, I don't think I was suited to be a very good litigator. I'm too objective. And partly it was I was working for, you know, you hear the old saying that people don't leave companies, people leave managers. That was very much the case in my sake. If I had been working for a better boss, or if I had gone into other types of law, like, say, trusts and estates, I would probably still be doing that, because I am not the sort of guy who is likely to give up something like that and chase a dream. I'm a pretty, you know, steady, keep your head down and go kind of guy. But as it turned out, you know, maybe I should be thankful that things aligned up the way they did, because otherwise I wouldn't be where I am now, and where I am now is pretty awesome.
It is, and I think sort of myself, hopefully a lot of the listeners will be in the same place, because you've generated so much stuff that's fed our habit. So I think it'd have been a bit of a loss if you hadn't have made the move.
My job is helping people to have fun. You know, I'm not providing you the entertainment like I would be if I were a novelist or an actor doing a movie, for example, or a director doing a movie. I'm giving you the tools to help you have fun. So, you know, I think that's a pretty awesome job.
Yeah, yes, it is. It sounds an ideal job, I think, to me, and probably quite a lot of other people.
Nothing makes me feel better than having somebody tell me how much they liked some book I wrote or how much fun they had playing some adventure I did. That, you know, always makes my, you know, heart grow another size and my head swell a little bit.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that, I don't think.
Yeah. You know, but yeah, because it's fun, you know, to be able to help people have fun and do things like that is, you know, I think it's a pretty awesome way to make a living, and I love it. It's not, not necessarily for everybody. Not everybody likes to work by themselves, you know, things like that. But it certainly has turned out very well for me.
I also imagine that I'm able to work from home occasionally. They're very flexible, which is quite nice. You know, I work in the IT industry, so I can dial into work, as it were. And I struggle. I prefer not to work at home because, I find there's too many distractions. I imagine in your trade, if you're not, you know, going into an office to, you know, to do the writing and development, et cetera, you have to be quite disciplined to put that time aside.
Yeah. In fact, for the first 2 or 3 weeks that I was working for myself, writing and designing games, I got up each morning, I put on my suit and my dress shirt and my tie and my good shoes and sat there dressed like I would be in an office because I felt that was sort of a motivating thing that, you know, this tells me I'm supposed to be working. But after about 3 weeks, I figured out I didn't really need that and quit wearing formal clothes and just wore whatever I felt like wearing. My sister a couple of years ago quit what she was doing to pursue her dream job. And while she loves it, she's come to the conclusion that she really doesn't like working at home by herself and is slowly winding down her business to go back to work with people because that's what energizes her and helps her, you know, get things done, is working with other people. And I'm just the opposite. I never want to go back to working for other people in an office in my life. And fingers crossed, I will never have to.
No, I can sympathize with that. I just don't seem to have your discipline, maybe. I think if I was working for myself, I'd be very poor very quickly.
Yeah, not everybody does. Working for yourself is a sort of a skill like any other. And, you know, but the benefits, on the other hand, are, you know, like, for example, I was able to help take care of my parents in their last years. Whenever they needed something, I could go take it to them. I could, you know, go have lunch with them. You know, if my father fell, I could immediately drive over and help him get back on his feet, things like that. And that was very important to me. You know, I'm sure at some point I would have gotten, you know, cited for contempt of court when I didn't turn off my cell phone and told the judge, "I don't care, Your Honor, my father fell and I'm leaving."
Yeah. Yes, very true, yes. I tried to do a little bit of research because, as I was saying, you know, in the early days, you know, when I was younger, I wasn't particularly interested in who the authors of products were or whatever. So I did a little digging around, but not too deep, just into this Wikipedia site and your own site. And I guess when you joined Hero Games, or sort of bought them out, because you were writing for them originally as well when you're on the side. I was wondering and you may not know this, what at the time, all those years ago, everything was, you know, I was playing sort of Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, and there were other systems out like Rollmaster. Moving to sort of this sort of point buy system where you get so many points and you could, was seemed really innovative. I don't think anyone else was doing that at that time.
I think there may have been some other games that did it early on to varying degrees. I think Champions was probably the first really popular game to do it that way. The first game that got out and influenced a lot of people to do things that way. I won't swear to it because I'm no, you know, universal historian of the role-playing game industry. But I think it's fair to say that Champions is one of the games, at the very least, that popularized the concept. You know, and also for me, at least, it was the first game to introduce me to the concept of what were then called disadvantages, or what now called complications. That, you know, wait a minute, my character can have, you know, negative sides to him. So the idea that I could have a secret identity or an enemy that hunts me all the time, or change into a werewolf during the full moon or what have you, you know, first edition D&D and some of the other games I had tried, none of them really had a system like that. You know, there was no way to do that. And it fascinated me that you know, and so like one of my early champ fantasy hero characters, for example, was a blind bard, you know, the sort of tradition of the blind bard like Homer. And I had a blast playing him. I don't know if they have them in England, but over here, when you go to the eye doctor and they dilate your pupils so they can look into your eyes, they give you these little plastic glasses that you can insert in your glasses so that the sunlight doesn't blind you when you go outside, right?
Yes, so, yeah, I've come across that, yes.
Yeah, I got a pair of those and I covered them up with opaque tape. And I would put them in my glasses, and then whenever I had to do something, I would roll the dice and get the guy next to me to read them. Because I was blind. And so I was role-playing being blind. And I had a lot of fun. I mean, that character wasn't the most combat-effective guy in the world, but he wasn't meant to be. I was playing something else. And I had a lot of fun with that. You know, and that would never have occurred to me playing Dungeons & Dragons, because D&D, at that time at least, didn't allow for things like that. It may be, maybe the 5th edition does. I don't know. I haven't had the chance to play it yet. But the 1st edition certainly did.
We lost track of D&D at 3.5, mainly just because of personal things. So, yeah, I was going to say, but I think you've probably already answered this. You know, what attracted you to the, I guess it would be Champions then?
Yeah, well, the truth is what attracted me really was I had just gotten back into reading comics. As a kid, I read all kinds of comics. But then through my early teenage years, I just somehow dropped out of the hobby of reading them. And my interest in them began to rise again. It coincided with starting to role play. And, you know, my group played D&D and nothing but D&D. Well, okay, D&D and occasional Traveler. For many, many years, my high school friends and I. And then I read about this game Champions in Dragon Magazine. I'm like, hey, superhero game. That should be fun. Let's try it. You know, and as luck would have it, a friend of mine lived in Atlanta, where at the time they had a really great game store called Sword of the Phoenix in Lenox Square Mall. Sadly, I don't believe it's there anymore. But he was coming back to town for a visit, and I arranged for him to get me a copy of the 2nd edition box set and bring it. We had originally started playing with a friend's copy. There was a guy in the local science fiction club who had gotten a copy, and we would use his copy to play, and he'd run for us. His name was Robin. He was a great GM. He had a great feel for how to do a superhero story in a role-playing game. And so eventually, I made a photocopy of the character creation section of his 2nd edition so that I could make characters on my own. And then when I got a copy, I passed that photocopy on to my friend John Grigney, and when he got a book, he passed it on to the next guy, and we ended up calling that photocopy the Sacred Scrolls as a gag. It passed one through one, and eventually, the last time John moved, he found it and brought it back to me. And so I now have it as part of my like old gaming files, as part of group lore, you know, just for fun. But that was how we started playing, and once we lommed onto Champions, we pretty much stopped playing D&D. And eventually we adopted it to fantasy and to other things. But initially we just played a lot of superhero games and had a fantastic time doing it. For some reason, the game just really grabbed our attention. And we went from there.
Yeah, I've loved the flexibility of the game. You know, the character exactly. Generation is is potentially the hardest piece, especially if you've not seen a system like that before, getting your head around the fact that you can make whatever you want.
I know some very talented game designers who just can't quite grasp it. The idea of building a lightning bolt as opposed to picking lightning bolt as a power is not something they can quite get a handle on. And that's okay, because Lord knows some of them have designed games that I can't get a handle on. You know, different strokes for different folks. And as long as we're all having fun, I don't care. You know, I think the point of a game is to have fun, and if you have fun with game X and I have fun with game Y, we're all having fun.
Yeah, that's very true.
Making fun of people's taste in games is like making fun of their taste in music. It's completely pointless.
That's very well put. I do see not a lot of that, but a little bit of that on social media. I think it's probably worse when, in my first, I guess, walkthrough RPGs. There seems to be a lot of stigma around, oh, you play this or you play that.
Part of that is just internet culture, I think. But, you know, some of it is just people have always been jerks to other people, and this is one more way to be a jerk.
Yes, I suppose, you know, it is.
When I was in high school, you know, I was making fun of other people's taste in music, and I'm sure it still is. But you can make fun of other people's taste in sport or their favorite team or Lord knows what else. And it's just all kind of pointless. One of the ways you grow up is you realize it's pointless.
That's very true. That's very philosophical for a quick interview. I had a quick brush up this afternoon and something I saw, but I had no awareness of, I confess. So I apologize. You strayed into the realms of writing. I don't know if you're still proactively doing that, but I believe you've written a few novels, haven't you?
No, I've written quite a few short stories.
Oh.
I have written a novel, but it has never been published. No one's accepted it for publication. But yeah, in the past few years, I've been focusing on fiction a little more, partly as a way of stretching my writing muscles. Writing fiction for me is very different than writing games, and in a lot of ways, it's much harder for me than writing games. And so I've been sort of expanding my portfolio, and, you know, I've dropped off that a little. You know, I'm more likely to write fiction these days when somebody asks me to, as opposed to writing fiction on spec and hoping I can sell it. But the fact is I do enjoy it. And, you know, someday I would like to get my novel published. It's just, you know, the question of getting my interest up to the level where I start putting it out there again. So.
Yeah, I know very little about that industry, but I know it's meant to be quite tough. And that sort of leads me into I warned you I might ask this, and it might be a bit too early in the company's history. I don't know. But a few years ago, I came across an author called Scott Sigler that I realized wrote an early supplement for the Champion system.
I know Scott. I don't know him real well, but yeah, he wrote. After I published Dark Champions, they published my Dark Champions, and then they published two follow-up books that I had written, I sent them another book and they split it into two because it was so big. And they realized they had a hit on their hands for the time period, for the early to mid 90s, Dark Champions was a big success. It sold out its first print run. They did another print run, and they realized they had something here that people wanted this type of use, this type of gaming stuff. And so they began looking at the existing manuscripts they had and trying to find ways to fit them into the Dark Champions quote line unquote, though it wasn't really a line. And one of the books that they focused on was, Dean Shamshak's, Creatures of the Night, horror enemies. But another one was Hudson City Blues, and the author's name is escaping me. Ed, I can't remember, unfortunately. But one of them was a manuscript that Scott had sent them. It was a series of three interlocked scenarios called Shadows of the City. And I don't know how much they retinkered it, if at all, but they decided it was appropriate for Dark Champions, and for the most part it was. And so they went ahead and published that. He also did a few other things for them, but that's the book he's best known for, I think. And I haven't seen or spoken to him in years. I met him probably at Gen Con or Origins sometime there in the mid-90s. And I know he's gone on to, he's written novels. I know he was part of a heavy metal band for a while.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that got me into the podcasting thing was although I don't live a particularly long way away from where I work, the traffic is terrible, so it takes me an hour each way. And yeah. I was just looking for things to listen to in the car, and I started with audio novels and then sort of progressed onto podcasts. And Scott, he very kindly records and makes most of his novels available freely on his website.
Oh, free audiobooks.
Yeah, he seems to be doing quite well. He's even got his own yearly con called Siglerfest.
Ha! That's awesome.
And Yeah. I mean, I really like him. He's the character that comes over at least when he's doing his introductions and he's voiced some of his own novels. It sort of really made me warm to him. And I was just curious, you know, if you'd work with him and what your general opinions were. Not putting you on the spot too much.
But his adventure, you know, his stuff was, it had a nice sort of creepy touch to it that I liked. You know, there were two or three authors that came along after me and published stuff for Dark Champions, whose work I really liked, and he was one of them.
Yeah, I think most of his novels tend to the sci-fi and slightly horror genre.
Yeah. And Shadows of the City was kind of the same way. It was partly superhero-y and partly horror. And so it could be fit into the Dark Champions concept more easily than their typical four-color adventure.
Yeah, I think I need to go and dig that out if I can. Might find a copy in eBay somewhere.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. That shouldn't be any problem at all.
So is there anything you're particularly working on now? I know you were saying that, you know, there's a couple of things in the pipeline, but is there anything you can sort of talk about and tease us with?
Sure. The main thing that I'm currently working on, there are a couple things that I'm under NDAs and can't talk about. Just to interrupt real quickly, there is a copy of Shadows of the City by Iron Crown on sale on eBay for $3.99. And there's only one, so I'd advise you to go jump on it.
Thank you.
But anyhow, the main thing I'm working on gaming-wise that I can talk about is a project that's very near and dear to my heart that I've been working at off and on for the past 6 years, roughly, called Mythic Hero. And Mythic Hero is a comprehensive guide to world mythology for gaming. It will have hero system stats in it, but the information about the gods and the mythologies and the cosmologies and the magic systems can really be adapted for any kind of game if you want to do that sort of thing. Mythology has been a huge interest of mine since I was a kid. It's really I got into reading fantasy, if you will, through my love of mythology. You know, in a certain sense, I can trace my entire career as a writer back to pulling a very specific book off the shelves when I was in like third grade, pulling off the school library. And so I'm sort of coming back full circle. The problem is it's such a huge project that it takes a lot of time. You know, I've been working on it 6 years. I've got a little over 400,000 words written. And at a guess, I'm maybe halfway through. I'm not really sure. You know, and then once I finish it, I have to figure out how to publish it, which will be a whole separate magilla. But that is currently occupying most of my writing time when I don't have something else under contract.
Similar to you, I was interested in mythology when I was younger. I sort of fell out of that, I think, really, with all the things coming along. Well, I guess role-playing, where you can sort of make your own mythology. I'd be really, really curious to know, what was the book? Can you remember?
Yeah, I can. It was Dallaire's Norse Gods and Giant by Emily and Olin Per Dular, the Swedish or Norwegian children's book illustrators. I have a copy of it. I still have a copy of it today. It was like, you know, when I discovered online book buying, you know, at the time before Amazon was selling used books, like, and you went to places like Advanced Book Exchange, that book was literally the first book I ever ordered online, because it had been on my wish list for many years and I'd never seen it on sale anywhere. And so I have my own copy today. But something about their way of illustrating and their way of talking about this mythology that was part of the background of their culture just really appealed to me. And to this day, Norse mythology is my favorite mythology. It's the closest I come to being an expert in one of them. My one nonfiction book that was published 2 years ago is an analysis of the Norse god Odin that I wrote for Osprey Publishing.
I noticed that on the wiki, actually. Yeah, so that must have been a real labor of love.
That is one of the books I'm proudest of. I wish they had been able to continue that line, because I would have wrote book after book after book after book for them. But they decided not to continue it, unfortunately.
Oh, that's a shame.
It is, but, I mean, Osprey being Osprey, they you know, I imagine they have certain sales figures they want to meet, and they're best known for their military stuff, and so they're sticking with what they do best. But, you know, you never know. I may write some more books like that now that I see how they do it. I could do that. You know, maybe I'll write some on my own once I'm done with Mythic Hero. Who knows?
Yeah, well, I think you get a fairly good audience for that. I know quite a lot of people that love the Norse mythology.
Well, a lot of what I want to do with Mythic Hero is introduce people to a lot of mythologies that have rarely, if ever, been done for gaming. Like Hittite, Finnish, Hawaiian, Yoruba. Not just the two or three you tend to learn about in school. And so that's a lot of the fun of it, is some of these I'm delving back into studying for the first time in 20 or 30 years. And so it's a lot of fun. And I'm basically, I've got a mythology library of about 1,200 volumes. And I'm just basically condensing that down into one book.
Wow. That's a lot of reading.
It is. And that's why it's taking so long, because it's a lot of research reading. But, you know, it's reading I enjoy. It's fun. It's hard to think of it as work.
Well, yeah, that's great. I'm getting more and more jealous as the conversation goes on. So, if given the opportunity at this moment in time, and we might maybe straying onto the non-disclosures, so tell me to shut up if we are. If someone was to give you an unlimited amount of resource and cash in the RP world, what would you really love to do that you haven't had opportunity to do?
Well, I have a file on my computer called Impossible Projects List. And it's a list of books I would love to work on, but that would take so much time or money that I can't just leap in and do them. And so I'd probably pick something off that list, which might include, I also collect maps and travel guides and exploration books from the 1920s and 30s. And I've wanted to use them for many years to write The Pulp Adventurer's Guide to the World, which would be a thorough look at the world of the 1920s and 30s, you know, with an emphasis on adventure gaming. I'd love to do a new edition of Western Hero. That would be another book on the list. I have an idea for a companion volume to Mythic Hero called Legendary Hero, which would cover characters like, for example, King Arthur and Aladdin, who are legends but not myths. You know, and there are a bunch of, what I'd probably do, if and when I finish Mythic Hero, what I'm probably going to do is go to the Hero Games website and or Facebook and or whatever other tools are available then, and post some surveys listing the three or four things I'm most interested in doing and seeing what people are most interested in paying for. Yeah. Just depending on, you know, where my interests and their interests lie. So these days I can be tempted to do outside work either through a project that really interests me because of the setting or the people working on it or what have you, or with a lot of money. Those are the two ways to stop working on Mythic Hero. So provided something like one of those things comes along, you know, I'd love to do it.
Yeah, the 1920s stuff sounds like it might fit quite well into the sort of the Call of Cthulhu type niche.
It would be very useful for Call of Cthulhu gaming, for, you know, pulp hero type gaming, but I can pull up. See, I mentioned I had 1,200 mythology books. I have 845 pulp era books in my library. I have these all cataloged on an app called Book Catalog, so I can look up how many I have. And so I not only would I have to read all of those, but I would have to find a way to easily and safely scan large maps that are 100 years old. You know, because my map, they're antiques, and you can't just run them through an ordinary scanner. And so I'd have to find some way to do archival scanning. And I'm sure there's a way to do it, but, you know, I'd have to figure that out first, because there's no sense having these resources and not using them.
No, it sounds fascinating.
You know, like I tell people, you know, if you need to know where the police station was on Gibraltar in 1934, I can pull out a map and show you exactly where it is. because I love having props like that. I love gaming with props and handouts and things. So the map collection sort of grew out of that.
I mean, I genuinely don't know if there's a lot of products out there that cover that era now.
There are some, but none of them cover it in the detail that I would cover it in, at the risk of sounding immodest.
No, not at all. Yeah, it sounds like it could be very interesting.
Yeah, it'd be a lot of fun. It's one of my favorite things about my job is researching real world subjects and turning them into gaming useful information. You know, because all of the information in Mythic Hero, for example, could be researched by any gamer out there who wanted to, but the fact is he may not have access to the books I have. He may not want to do all that work. I'm providing him an easy way to do it. And in fact, I'm doing it in such a way that I may even just strip out the game material at some point and publish a version just for people who want the mythological information, because there's lots of great stuff in there. It's weird what different cultures were interested in that affected their religion and their mythology.
Yeah, the history of how they got there I find quite intriguing, yeah.
For example, the Finnish mythology is, they often tell you the color of the god's socks. And I assume that's because it's really cold in Finland. On the other hand, they don't have a whole lot of gods of water because they've got all the water they need. If you look at the Aztecs, they have all kinds of gods of water because they live in a desert. But on the other hand, they don't care at all what color the god's socks are because they weren't wearing socks.
Yeah, that's interesting. Sounds obvious now you say it, yeah, that they're more potent or more prolific gods would be the things that they desire the most or need the most, yeah.
Yeah, one of the things that I've been keeping a little file of, like, what I call weird mythological facts that I come across that I could eventually at some point, you know, put them in a blog or, you know, just release them as promo, you know. So, for example, I can tell you that the only pantheon on Earth that I'm aware of that features a god of the armpit is the Chinese pantheon.
Yeah, that's so intriguing how they decided they needed a god of the armpit.
The old mythos that features a god of pickles is the Baltic mythos. You know, different people are interested in different things.
So I noticed we're coming up to the hour, Steve. So I'll probably call it in a few minutes. But I've got one question that I'm quite intrigued to know the answer to. So again, you know, I'm only really playing Hero System at the moment and not really looking at anything else, but because of, you know, the interaction on Twitter and Facebook, etc., there seems to be a really big drive over the last year or two to move towards less sort of rules heavy and more role play based games. In fact, I think some of the newer games have very, very few rules. All the rules are about how you tell the story rather than the mechanics of the world or whatever. I'd be curious to know what your take on that was, because although I prefer a role-play heavy game, I think. Although in my earlier years, it was just about kicking the doors in and, you know, improving your character stats-wise. As I've got older, you know, I've enjoyed the role-play side more, but some of them seem to be almost afraid of having too many rules, which I find intriguing, I think. I don't know whether to just see it as a different view of everything.
In a sense, that may be true. I mean, I like to think of role-playing games sort of on a spectrum. And way over here on the left, you have the rules light, heavier narrative or storytelling, whatever term you want to use, games. And for my money, the defining boundary mark there is probably Jason Morningstar's game Fiasco. And then on the other hand, you have the really, really rules-heavy games. But the truth is, I don't think that narrative gaming necessarily requires being rules-light, and I don't think that being rules-heavy means you can't role-play as well. One of the reasons that I like the Hero System so much is that it makes it, easier for me to roleplay because I can more precisely define my character. The rules with the hero system let me give my character whatever I want, however I want it, and inflict whatever difficulties I want to on him. That makes me want to roleplay that character. I've built him. He's not just an assemblage of numbers. I don't need rules light to make me want to roleplay. Nor do I need rules heavy. Again, I think it all gets back to how do you have fun? Some people don't want to be, have to learn a lot of rules. Some people don't care. Some people really like having a lot of rules. As long as everybody at the table is having fun, I think we're good.
Yeah, I completely agree.
I love playing the rules light games. I love playing the rules heavy games. My group tends towards the rules heavy games, but that's just the nature of the beast. The next time we show up and somebody wants to run one-shot game, maybe we'll try something else. We were talking the other day about trying a Dungeon World game that one of my friends had read about and was kind of interested in. So we may try that at some point. Really, with my gaming group, it boils down to who wants to run, what does he want to run, we'll play whatever he wants to run because we want to play. We have a group where we don't have one of those people who always wants to run. Unfortunately, if we had one of those, our group would be perfect.
Yeah, I always seem to fall into that role.
Yeah.
For some reason, I think I'm far from the best role player in our group, so role playing lots of NPCs I find quite challenging. But
if I show up and I say, hey, I want to play Fate, everybody in the group will be happy to play Fate because I want to run it. If I show up and say, I want to play Aftermath, they'll play that too. It's just a question of getting characters made. And 5 hours later, when we all have an Aftermath character, we can start playing.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever played Aftermath. But yeah,
it's an early, early FGU game that requires a lot of... Talking about rules heavy, the Aftermath has rules for stopping when you run. If you don't declare that you're stopping running soon enough, you run into things. Or it used to. Maybe it's been redesigned since then. I don't know. I haven't looked at it in decades.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things I do love about Champions is that Champions and now Hero System, I guess, is that the core rules is all 3d6, target of 11 with adders or modifiers, pluses or minuses. And although sometimes it can get a little bit complex in the combat and damage resolution, I think, depending on advantages and disadvantages and killing attacks and non-killing attacks and that sort of thing. The core is so simple. It's really elegant, I think.
A lot of people are turned off by most of the complexity of the hero system comes in character creation. Once you get past character creation, you're not doing a whole lot of math for the most part. Sometimes you do have to add dice when you're attacking and you have to figure out what defenses apply. But I've taught many, 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 many people how to play the hero system. It's really not that difficult. It's just a question of thinking in a different way. Roll the dice this way, not that way. Count them this way, not that way. And once you get past that, once you get that, in your head, you're good to go.
Amazingly elegant at its core, I think. Yeah, I've seen the thing about character generation, and I think it can be, but I tend to have as much fun generating the characters as, I don't get to play very often. But
for a lot of people, the metagame of creating hero system characters is part of the fun. What can I do with the system that's, I haven't seen done before? What would this effect be? How would this interact with this? And that is genuinely part of the fun for them. But it's the same way, it's genuinely part of the fun of playing D&D or Pathfinder, to see, if I combine this feat and this feat or this skill and this feat or what have you, I can do this really nifty thing. Some people like playing that way, and that's fine by me. I'm certainly not going to tell them that they're wrong. As we often say on the hero boards, change whatever rules you want. We're not sending the gaming police after you.
Yeah, that's very true. I think some of us, and I think I've been guilty of it in the past, sometimes take it too seriously.
It happens. Part of me would love to live in a world like Knights at the Dinner Table, where official rules handed down on high from the company regarded as holy writ. But most of me does not want that responsibility.
I think we probably should wrap it up. I'll try not to take up any more of your time. But if people want to see more about you, more about the Hero System or projects you or maybe your colleagues are working on, where's the best place for them to go?
Well, for Hero Games, the best place to go would be www.herogames.com. And for me, for my very infrequently updated website, it's just www.stephensslong.com. And I should get better about updating it more frequently. You can also follow me on, you know, Facebook and, to a much lesser extent, Twitter. And the same thing goes for Hero Games. So stop on by and say hi.
If people want to help you push your novel, who should they be badgering?
Well, if and when I get my novel published, believe me, I will sing out loud.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for your time this afternoon, and thank you for your patience. It's been quite awkward getting this sorted out, mostly me moving the goalposts, to be honest.
Timing anything is weird enough, and when we're dealing with me being four or five time zones ahead of you, or behind you, rather.
So, yeah, thank you very much for your time, Stephen.
You're welcome. And I sent you a link to that copy of Shadows of the City on eBay.
Oh, that's brilliant. Thank you very much.
No problem.
And yes, as I say, I've become quite a fan of Mr. Sigler, so I think I shall go and hunt that down.
Yeah, I think you'll like it. Thanks again, and let me know when it's up, and I'll publish links to it.
Yeah, will do. I will try and get this up as soon as possible, because this is our little claim to fame, and I really appreciate you taking the time out to help us.
Anytime. Thanks again, and enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Yeah, you too. Thank you for listening to Chimpions. If you've listened to earlier episodes, you'll realise this is a labour of love on our part. So, if you enjoy what we're doing and would like to help support the show, please go to iTunes or Stitcher and leave us a review. We'd also love to hear what listeners think we could do to improve the show's content and format. You can find us on Twitter at ChimpionsRPG. Email me at mark@chimpions.co.uk. Through the contact section of the website at chimpions.co.uk. So if you love me, let me go. I'm far away before I know. My heart is just too dark to care. I can't destroy what is in there. Deliver me into my pain. I'm alone, I cannot hate. I don't deserve to have you. My smile was taken long ago. If I could change your hope, I never know.